You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Hello again, New York and listeners around the world. I'm Andy Borowitz in for Leonard Lopate on WNYC and WNYC.org. Scott Peterson, reporter for the Christian Science Monitor, has reported extensively on Iran for the past 15 years. In his new book, Let the Swords Encircle Me, Iran, A Journey Behind the Headlines, he reports on Iran's politics and often contradictory culture and gives voice to the Iranian people. The book is published by Simon & Schuster, and it's my pleasure to welcome Scott Peterson to the Leonard Lopate Show today. Hello, Scott.
Hello.
Now, Scott, we were just saying your timing with this book is exquisite because it's coming out the same week that Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is in New York. Is there some way that you could get this book into his hands so he could condemn it in front of the General Assembly? I mean, you have sort of the reverse Hugo Chavez, Noam Chomsky effect. It might be good for your numbers. I don't know.
Well, exactly. We've been working with Simon & Schuster for weeks to make sure that would happen.
But somehow.
We haven't gotten a sign-off yet from the Iranian mission at the UN.
Well, it would be great. But of course, you know, you've written this book on Iran, and it's a good time for a book on Iran. But when isn't it a good time for a book on Iran?
This is exactly right. I mean, I've been working on this book for 3 years. I've actually intended to write a book about Iran for the last decade, as a matter of fact. So all of the 30 visits that I've made to Iran, you know, in the last 15 years have really kind of been aimed toward gathering as much material as I could, hearing as many voices as I could, and really from across the spectrum in Iran to try and kind of tell their story, but also give a sense too, especially for an American audience for whom a lot of this material is going to be kind of counterintuitive, unexpected. You know, this is kind of, I think, the most pleasurable thing about being a journalist writing about Iran is that most of your audience really knows so little about Iran. And so everything that you write is kind of an unexpected fruit.
Well, when you say most of your audience knows very little about Iran, of course you're referring to me because I read what I, you know, the headlines, and the headlines give one view. And of course you've been there 30 visits, and this began 15 years ago?
That's right. 1996 actually was the first visit.
And what impelled you to make that very first visit?
Well, I was recently appointed the Middle East correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, and I was based in Amman, Jordan, but my remit really stretched from Algiers all the way across to Tehran. So I had the entire region. I was also making numerous trips to Israel. So there was a lot on my plate. But Iran, from the first, really kind of captivated me, and I recognized – I mean, I've been a foreign correspondent for 22 years. I've written a book about Africa, spent years in Africa in the early 90s going to Somalia. I covered the genocide in Rwanda and really had a lot of countries that I'd been visiting. But Iran always captivated me in a way that few other countries ever did, and part of it was because of how open people are in so many respects, and also – because there's a particular challenge in reporting on Iran. You have to have a very strategic view when you're dealing with stories there. I mean, for example, I in the introduction I described this kind of 9-year quest for a single story that I was working on and just chipping away, you know, over time to get there. And when I finally got to it, it proved to be an exceptional story, but it's just one piece of a really, really broad, bright and exciting mosaic about what Iran really is.
So you have to be in Iran, you have to be slow and steady.
You have to think very strategically.
Okay, so 1996, that was your first visit. How has the country changed from then? That's a ways back.
Well, since then, it's extraordinary. We've seen two incredible waves of political change in Iran. The first is that within a year of my first visit, we saw the election of Mohammad Khatami in 1997. And this began kind of a cultural Tehran spring is what we call it. And for several years, there was this incredible opening. Books that had been censored for years, films that had been censored for years, all of these things all of a sudden became open and available in Tehran and across Iran. A lot of other things changed. And of course, at the same time and in the background, we had hardliners and conservatives in Iran feeling that really kind of the revolution, Iran's 1979 Islamic revolution, that, you know, the ideals were being undermined by all this openness. So they began to plot their own comeback. So in the space of these last 14 or 15 years, we've seen the rise and fall of Mohammad Khatami's reform movement. We've also seen the rise and now decline of the neoconservatives as today represented by Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and some of these other hardliners who are running the show today.
I'm Andy Borowitz in for Leonard Lopate today. I'm talking to Scott Peterson, the author of Let the Swords Encircle Me, Iran, A Journey Behind the Headlines. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. Now, when you talk about the Tehran Spring, that's I consider myself a fairly well-read guy. That's really the first time I've heard about this. This was not reported here extensively. I mean, does our government or do we not recognize when good things are happening in Iran, or does the media not recognize it, or what's the problem? Why don't we know about this?
Well, you know, it's interesting because the same time that was going on was the same time that we had some very high profile, kind of overtures that were made both from the Iranian side and also from what was then the Clinton administration. Mm-hmm. So one thing I think that really Americans were aware of was when Mohammad Khatami had his interview with Christiane Amanpour on CNN, and he reached out and said, you know, Americans and Iranians are very, very similar. The American Revolution and what it stood for was very similar to some of the ideals we had of the Islamic Revolution. We're all aiming to be free peoples. We're all individuals and respect that individuality and the rule of law. So he cast this kind of, you know, move toward a closer, some kind of relationship in very, very positive terms. And that was kind of Iran's overture to the U.S. And likewise, on the U.S. side, many, many steps were taken. Of course, all of this was eventually undermined by hardliners on both sides, in fact, who wanted to be sure that the U.S. and Iran really never came back together. But that political change also happened in conjunction with the cultural opening, brief as it was, for those several years in Iran.
What were things like during this Tehran Spring? What could you feel on the street when you were out there?
What was extraordinary was the expectations that Iranians had that things were changing for the better, and that the revolution itself, after so many years, now nearly two decades old, was beginning to evolve in a positive way. People were again really using the word freedom, personal freedoms, and it was clear from their voting patterns and from the things that they were saying that this is really what the majority wanted coming from Iran in those days. So there were great expectations, huge, huge hopes. And I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, fast forwarding a decade, why we've seen so much unhappiness with the fact that there's been this crackdown in Iran over the past year, because those same aspirations really have been stepped on repressively and brutally by the government.
Now, the Khatami regime was, in some ways, a more open regime and was encouraging these overtures with the U.S., but it wasn't it also a very bloody regime at the same time?
Well, you know, interestingly enough, it wasn't remotely as bloody as previous governments.
I guess everything is relative, right?
Right. It is relative. Well, no, in fact, things really did, clean up. There were some incidents during the Khatami period. For example, there were some serial killings in which five or six people, intellectuals, were murdered inside Iran. And in fact, the high point of the Khatami presidency was actually purging the intelligence ministry from these kind of rogue death squads, if you will, at the time. But not to confuse the period that Khatami in the late 90s oversaw a general easing of that kind of activity compared to the previous, say, 10 or 15 years, when the Islamic government sent hit squads to kill opponents in Europe and in a lot of places around the world, and those numbered more than 100. So there were a lot of very vicious murders.
So that was more institutionalized hit squads, and these were more rogue hit squads.
Absolutely right.
I'm just trying to get our hit squad nomenclature straight.
Correct.
It can get confusing. Now, it's got to be awfully challenging as a Western journalist reporting in Iran, and it's a strange situation because now, of course, it's to some extent a closed society. They're not eager to have us reporting there, but they haven't gone the route of North Korea and sort of just pulled down the curtain. What do you think they're up to? Why are they letting you in, and why are you getting to write a book? And how did you do it? What kind of hoops did you have to go through?
Well, it was never easy getting a single one of these 30 visas.
30 visas.
To visit Iran. But I, along with a host of other journalists who regularly covered Iran, Western journalists and also Iranian Americans and others, almost nobody has been allowed back in since the June 2009 election. And of course, that is what precipitated this incredible street violence and this huge demonstrations against the government, accusing the election and the re-election of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad as being fraudulent. So people took to the streets. The crackdown was absolutely brutal. And those of us who wrote about it, I mean, of course, my visa expired a couple of days after the vote, so I had to leave. And eventually, within the space of 2 weeks, almost every Western journalist had to leave Iran. None of us hardly have been allowed back in. I certainly have a visa pending, but I don't expect to be let back in. And so, you know, really that curtain has dropped down right now. And so those of us who know Iran quite well have had to really rely on the contacts who we knew before, finding encrypted ways of communicating with them, you know, so that people feel safe in describing what they're seeing and what they're feeling and kind of the mood on the streets. And, you know, it really has changed the way that we cover Iran. So fortunately, my last visit, my 30th visit was during the election. It was obviously a crucial time. And of course, all the threads of this book and the history of the Islamic Republic come together in these events and, of course, in the final chapter of the book.
Now, when you say encrypted ways of talking to people, that sounds very tantalizing. It sounds very James Bond. I mean, how did you do that? What were the encrypted ways you dealt with people? You communicated with them.
Well, they're different. They're different ways that you can speak on. You know, using either iChat, for example, or different ways of internet communication, Skype, for example. These have varying levels of encryption, some of which can be cracked by by the Islamic government in Iran, and some of which can't. So using those, depending on what your sources' access is to the internet or to computers. This is a critical thing. And I think also one thing that probably is pretty safe, Iran is a country with tens of millions of mobile phones. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine that all of those lines are being listened to, watched, and everything else. Probably one of the safest ways to speak to people in Iran is actually on a good old landline, real live telephone, because I'm not sure I don't think they have the resources to listen to those too.
So hang on to your landline.
Absolutely.
That's one of the reasons to do it.
Old-fashioned.
My guest is Scott Peterson. His book is Let the Swords Encircle Me, Iran, A Journey Behind the Headlines. It's published by Simon & Schuster. We're going to take a short break. Stay with us. I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lopate, and I'm talking to Scott Peterson, the author of Let the Swords Encircle Me, Iran, A Journey Behind the Headlines. It's WNYC and WNYC.org. Now, I have to ask you a question. Where does that title of your book come from, Let the Swords Encircle Me?
Well, the first time I ever actually saw it was on a poster that was in a huge, huge martyr cemetery or cemetery south of Tehran. It's called Behesht-e Zahra Cemetery. And often you have, the martyrs of the Iran-Iraq War play a critical role in kind of shaping the ideology of the leadership today, those who fought in that war in the 1980s. And for Iran and Iraq, they were fighting each other. The Iranian side portrayed this as a sacred war. And so ever since then, the ideology behind that has been something that is really shaping leaders like Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and some of these other hardline Revolutionary Guard commanders. So what I came across was this poster, and it had this remarkable logo, if you will. It has 16 swords. They were curved, but they were all pointed toward the center, and there were drops of blood in the middle. Of course, the iconography of revolutionary Iran is something extraordinary and really taps back into, the Shiite history of Iran, which goes back centuries. So the title itself actually comes from the man who in 680 AD, Imam Hussein, became the Lord of the Martyrs for the Shiites in Iraq, what was then in Karbala, on the plains of Karbala. And what he said was he was surrounded by tens of thousands of the enemy, and he was just standing there alone with his 72 believers. So they were outnumbered. Of course, they were going to be killed. He had this great statement in which he said, "If the religion of Muhammad can only survive with my death, then let the swords encircle me." And he opens up his tunic and, of course, is killed and becomes the Lord of the Martyrs. So this encapsulates the Iranian regime's idea of resistance, of taking on a much stronger enemy. It's the kind of thing that we see in threads as Iran is defiant towards the United States over its nuclear ambitions. All of these things are wrapped up into this idea of resistance against a much, much stronger force and the nobility of that.
And the sense of being embattled.
Absolutely.
And we help, not we, but our government helps stoke that every time we stand up to Iran, because that just, they say, bring it on. Let the swords encircle me. Let's do this.
Right? Absolutely right. And in fact, and you do see that, you know, I mean, very much I think that the Iranian government for 31 years has felt that Washington is the gift that keeps on giving.
That's
in
right.
terms of criticism. And I think that likewise on the, you know, just as many of the opponents of the Iranian regime feel that about Ahmadinejad, that he, because of his huge voice and hot air, is the gift that keeps on giving.
Right. Well, we'll have to – before you leave today, you're going to have to tell me how we're going to solve that problem, because it sounds like a very vicious cycle. It's been going on for a while. Now, America is if not always considered the great Satan. We're certainly bad guys over there in the eyes of a lot of people over there. Could you walk us through the history of this? When did things – really good. Was it with Mossadegh? Was that when things really went bad with
that? You've put your finger on the first real incident that Iranians refer to all the time as feeling that their faith in the United States was undermined. And this was in 1953. The CIA orchestrated, along with British intelligence and, you know, kind of making it up as they went along, but they orchestrated the first coup ever conducted by the CIA, overthrew the popularly elected Prime Minister Mossadegh, and really kind of squashed out that moment of democracy inside Iran. And that is something that Iranians constantly point to as saying, you know, we need an apology for that. How could you possibly do that and undermine all the goodwill that other individual Americans and that the U.S. government had actually demonstrated toward Iran in the previous decades in a number of different ways. Now, of course, since then, another thing that Iranians, and especially, of course, those who are in favor of the government, are against, is the fact that the United States was extremely close to the Shah of Iran up till 1979. So the Shah, they see as, you know, the tool of repression. His SAVAK intelligence agency and internal security was trained by the CIA. And in fact, in the book, I go into an actual prison. One of the prisons that's in downtown Tehran that's been turned into a torture museum. And you can't believe the scenes inside this museum, because what you've got is they've got mannequins that are – or wax figures that have been, you know, are torture victims. There's blood pouring down them. There are actually bloody footprints that are following on the floor of this prison that have been painted on. And what those are depicting is the fact that one of the favorite tortures in this place was, you know, we're binding people to a chair and then whipping their feet with different size whips, different caliber whips, if you will. So often their feet were bleeding. But the extraordinary thing is that many of the torturers are depicted as Americans. They're wearing business shirts. They're wearing suspenders, holding up their trousers.
As we Americans do.
They've got a tie. That's how they're portraying it. There's a bottle of whiskey sitting on this desk. And they really make it clear that this was a joint operation against the Iranian people by SAVAK and the Shah and the United States and the CIA.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is more let the swords encircle me. It's more, you know, blood and martyrdom and victimization. And
absolutely.
So that's the message that's being sent here.
Absolutely right in that case. And of course, the one thing that sticks in everyone's mind, crucially for Americans, is the hostage saga of 1979. It began in 1979. It didn't end until the first days of 1981 when Ronald Reagan was inaugurated.
I remember as he was being inaugurated, there was a split screen, and they showed as he was being sworn in, they showed the hostages being delivered.
Precisely right on day 444. And of course, the regime takes, you know, and those hostage takers, you know, take credit for having, like, you know, made an American president fall.
But and they created Ted Koppel's career as well.
It certainly did. I also remember those scenes, day 363.
Yeah, America held hostage. That's right.
Precisely.
That's right. Well, you know, but let's go back. Let's go back to the Mossadegh thing, because that did obviously – that led inexorably to where we are now and the Islamic Revolution and all that. Why did we make that choice? We made a very clear choice that we were going to overthrow democracy, and we are always the ambassadors of democracy. And we're trying to bring democracy to Iraq and Afghanistan, or we say we are. Why did we had it there in the Middle East? Why did we say enough of that?
We were convinced that this was the thing to do, primarily by the British. And the British, of course, had their own axe to grind against Mossadegh, who just a couple of years before had actually nationalized Iran's oil sector. And prior to that, it was the British who had been depending upon Iran's really vast oil reserves to fuel their own economy and do everything else. So the British really felt the need for revenge against Mossadegh in that sense. We're able to convince the Americans, not necessarily for the oil reason, but looking at it more in terms of geostrategic reasons, in terms of, you know, if this doesn't happen, then Mossadegh, who has like communist sympathies, is going to really fall into the Soviet camp, et cetera, et cetera. So it really became a Cold War justification,
thing, yeah.
Precisely. And that's where Washington made their decision.
So now we have a structure, if you want to call it that, in Iran, where to a lot of Americans, we see Ahmadinejad speaking at the UN, I guess to kind of an empty hall. Did he didn't get much of a crowd, huh?
That's right. Not the first time, but we'll see if he draws more in a second round.
It depends. You know, there's a lot going on in New York, so people might have been somewhere else.
Those diplomats had much more to do, I'm sure.
Had more to do. So, but he's kind of the figurehead, and he is a very colorful character, and he gets a lot of press and a lot of TV time. But then you also have the Revolutionary Guard and some people say, well, wait a minute, they're thugs, but they're really the ones in charge. And then you have other people saying, no, wait a minute, it's the clerics, it's the Ayatollah, he's in charge. Who's in charge? Do they all think they're in charge? Do you have a sort of a flow chart that can show who reports to whom? I mean, what's going on?
Such a flowchart, if one were ever to create one that were accurate, would actually look like a series of Venn diagrams.
Oh,
right?
That's bad news.
No,
for my understanding.
This would be like a three-dimensional fluid matrix, mm-hmm. right? Of like power centers that also fluctuated in their ability to exercise power and their ability to use it. President Ahmadinejad has a huge voice, and because of some of the things he says, he has this also. You know, the things he's said resonated very much across the Arab world and a lot of other places. But his actual power fluctuates according to those who are his primary enemies in Iran, and there are many. I mean, this is the most divisive president, I think, that we've had in the Islamic Republic's 31-year history. He has made even fellow conservatives, many of them, fight against him, speak out against him, and really try and undermine him because they're afraid of where he's taking Iran. But at the same time, he's also locked in this kind of love-hate relationship with the supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who is supposed to be the guy who has the final say on all these state issues, but sometimes can find himself being outmaneuvered or simply neglected, if you will, by this president. And then the other element too, as you absolutely rightly point out, is that the Revolutionary Guards, especially in the 5 years that Ahmadinejad has been president, have also really seen a rise not only in their political influence, but also very much in their economic influence. They now control large chunks of the economy, and as such, are then able to exercise all the more influence. And there's no chance of that power at the moment diminishing at all.
I'm Andy Borowitz in for Leonard Lope today. I'm talking to Scott Peterson. He is the author of Let the Swords Encircle Me, Iran, A Journey Behind the Headlines. It's WNYC and WNYC.org. Well, now, those are the people who are in charge, and there seem like it is a complicated structure as you've walked us through it. But Iran has a very, very young demographic. And the people on the streets may have a slightly different view of things than the people in charge. First of all, how young a country is it? Let's try to put that in some perspective.
You are so right to put your finger on that, because really the fact is, and I'm sure this is one of the things that makes the regime quake every night, is that one of the results of the revolution is that not only did you have a surge of births in the first year after 1979, which has meant that basically more than 70% of the population are under 30 years old, but you also have them all really quite well educated. So you've got a young, well educated population that is suffering from huge unemployment.
How big is the unemployment there?
Oh, it's 20%. Give or take 5%. Official figures are very difficult. It's actually – the official figures are less than that. I mean, less than 15%. But it can be, you know, unofficial figures are what we're, you know, what we're not sure of. The point is that the economy can't keep up at all with with all the college graduates who are coming out, with all those who are looking for work. So this just stokes the level of disillusionment, the unhappiness, and the feeling, the very broad feeling among Iranians that really the revolution and its promises of justice, of economic justice – really have really not been fulfilled.
And don't you also have a problem? I mean, this is just based on my experience. If you have young people who are unemployed and have a lot of time on their hands, they're going to spend a lot of that time on the internet and on their phones, right? And so they're good communicators and good disseminators of dangerous ideas, at least from the regime's point of view.
They were the absolute backbone of the green movement unrest that we saw in the aftermath of the election last June 2009. They were the ones who mobilized. They were the ones who used their mobile phones, who used the internet, and I think really caught the regime off guard in terms of how they were able to mobilize. I mean, these days now, the regime has learned a lot. It knows how to shut down a lot of those systems, you know, so that people can internally mobilize. But that doesn't mean that the actual widespread underlying unhappiness and potential unrest is gone. And that's why I think some people, you know, kind of make a mistake when they say, well, the green movement's dead. It's not dead at all. It's just not visible at the moment. I mean, in the same way, for example, that, you know, we don't doubt the presence of the sun when there's, you know, when it's a cloudy day. The sun's still there. Likewise, this green movement exists in a way that just we're not seeing it now, but that potential is absolutely there.
I just assumed after that green movement started that the Ayatollah would then follow everyone in the country on Twitter, that that would be the first thing that would happen. Is Twitter still being used as a way of communicating, or has it been largely neutralized?
That's been largely neutralized by the regime. But another thing too, they have actually deployed these kind of like cyber war, you know, militants. I mean, they have come up with their own kind of counter propaganda on the web and elsewhere. And one thing to remember also about Twitter was that and even the internet is that also, even though Iran is a country that has more, and I think Farsi maybe, you know, behind English is practically the most well used language in the blogosphere. I mean, you can't believe there are tens of thousands of Farsi language blogs and blogs about Iran. I mean, just endless. I mean, Iranians are incredible bloggers. So, you know, those are things that tap, you know, that people are reading all the time. But also, you know, it also suits really a particular demographic who have computers, who have fast enough internet lines and things like that. And of course, that's not every Iranian.
Well, you know, getting back to the comparison between North Korea, I mean, we're not getting any tweets out of North Korea, to my knowledge. I mean, I actually think Kim Jong-il recently did. Somebody opened a Twitter account for him. I don't know what he's been, you know, saying, you know, what he loved Inception. I don't know what he's been talking about. But why is Iran trying to sort of create the illusion that it's not a military state like North Korea, that it's sort of an open society? So they're letting little dribs and drabs out, but they're not totally, because they could really crack down if they wanted to totally crack down, couldn't they, or could they?
Well, they could, but, you know, not to confuse the North Korean people, who obviously for a very, very long time have had no say, with the Iranian population, which bubbles, ferments with political kind of agitation, insight, viewpoints, willingness, and, you know, the fact that they have these tens of thousands of blogs in the blogosphere tells you that people are looking for ways to communicate. The regime will never be able to shut this down. And this is something that I've found inside Iran that you really can't find practically anywhere else in the entire region. I mean, this is specific to Iran. And of course, Iranians are themselves arrogant about this. I mean, in the sense that, you know, they have this 2,500, you know, years of history. It's full of all kinds of extraordinary events, extraordinary things. And they're very, you know, they're very arrogant about it in a lot of ways. And of course, you know, it's a similar arrogance. You know, there's a lot of arrogance also in the United States about its, you know, about its history and about its, you know, its place in the world. I mean, Iranians have told me explicitly that they feel the same manifest destiny for themselves that the United States has always had in its history, and calls it manifest destiny.
So maybe a more apt comparison might be something like Poland, you know, in the early days when solidarity was sort of became the first kind of seed of revolution. And maybe that's what the Iranian government is so worried about.
Well, it's interesting. You know, in the book, I explain one of the things that really, really they are concerned about, the government in Iran, is the possibility of a velvet revolution. Mm-hmm. And they've gone on and on about this, and it's been a concern for years. And as a matter of fact, more than a decade ago, the Supreme Leader ordered a careful examination of every single example of regime change in previous decades. They explored how it was that a man like Nelson Mandela, after 25 years in prison, could become the leader of South Africa. They explored how a playwright like Vaclav Havel could become later on a president. They explored how all these different examples, and of course they looked at every single case of Velvet Revolution that we've seen. Now, I, as a journalist, I reported on the fall of Milosevic in Belgrade. I reported on the Rose Revolution in Georgia. I was based in Moscow during the Orange Revolution in Ukraine. So I was able to pull together some of the elements of that and really try and examine carefully about what elements of Velvet Revolution actually were manifest inside Iran over the last year and year and a half. And there's no question that some of the similarities are extraordinary. And the regime has a lot to worry about, no question.
Well, Scott, there is clearly not enough time to do this topic justice, but you're written a great book and you have a website. Tell me a little bit about your website.
That's right. On the website, which is www.s-peterson.com. S-peterson.com. Well, of course, if you just write Scott Peterson and do a Google search, I can quite assure you that you'll get a lot of other hits that won't have anything to do with
this book. Sorry about that.
Yeah, I know, me too. But what to do? In any event, there's a lot of imagery there. Of course, there's a photo insert in the book, but what you'll find on the website is a lot more detail about Iran and the photographs and other things, not just about Iran, but other countries that I've covered as well. But really, that imagery is a perfect complement to the book because it explains a lot more about what we're talking about.
Well, thanks for coming on the show today. My guest has been Scott Peterson, that one. His book is Let the Swords Encircle Me, Iran, A Journey Behind the Headlines, published by Simon & Schuster. And Scott, thanks again.
With pleasure. Thank you.